This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Daly. Our guest this week is Dan Bossi, president of Ag Resource Company. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with Dan Bossi next. Today's Open Mic segment is brought to you by America's Crop Insurance Industry, which is thankful for the continued support of farmers, commodity organizations, rural businesses, lenders, and lawmakers who are fighting to maintain a strong farm safety net, providing individualized protection on more than 490 million acres of farmland. Crop insurance remains the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. Market economist Dan Bossi has been involved in grain trading since the late 1970s. Ag Resource Company's insights into commodity markets spans 81 nations, including both producers and end users. Bossi says the domestication of the U.S. grain market is underway, despite China's purchases of billions of dollars of U.S. agriculture commodities today.
Well, when I first got in this business, Jeff, in 1979, the U.S. accounted for 63% of global ag trade. By that, I'm saying we were the dominant factor, and I spend most of my time focusing on, you know, U.S. balance sheets and trying to better understand the opportunities to come. These days, that number has slipped to 11 or 13%, depending on the crop year. And, you know, the Black Sea or Russia has become the predominant wheat exporter. Brazil just took over the crown as being the world's largest corn exporter and also, of course, has soybeans. So, you know, the world trade arena has changed dramatically as I think backwards in my time here. And there's some big changes on the forefront, which we can talk a little later about the arrival of India as a significant importer, which we now anticipate in the next 5 to 10 years. But in saying that, you know, U.S. agricultural trade is still very, very important to overall price direction. It's the kind of thing that we get data on twice a week. We of course, focus on it very acutely. Places like Chicago Board of Trade have formulated their futures contracts on an export market down Illinois and other river markets. And so all of this is very important in terms of where we go. But again, I think as we look backwards, we're going to find ourselves probably not in the same catbird seat of world trade as we used to be.
So, Dan, let's talk about transitions and possible paradigm shifts that may appear or are already appearing that may have a significant impact on price discovery and farm income between today and then to the end of this new farm bill in 2028. First of all, I'll ask, what about the U.S. economy and the global economy from here today looking forward?
Well, as we look at the economic outlook, I mean, almost every week that goes by, we become less concerned about a recession. I don't think it's completely off the table, but I think more and more a soft landing, or maybe we've had rolling recessions that really haven't culminated into a big event for the U.S. economy. So now as we get very close to the U.S. Central Bank with its last interest rate hike that we foresee for now, and then hitting the pause button long, you know, higher for longer, I think that's the thesis going forward. You know, the ag economy is suffering a little bit because of farm income dipping as costs rise and also as trade declines. USDA is projecting about a 16% drop in net farm revenue this year, which is important to the U.S. farmer. He's still making money, mind you. But again, several years of this will become difficult and unpalatable for him again, and that's something we need to watch. When I think about the global landscape and where we are today, of course, geopolitical events in the Black Sea is to the front of our mind this week. But I am encouraged by, I think, the arrival of a new big importer and a consumer called India. We may be several years off from India really being the importer that we'd like to see them, but I think their recent problems with the monsoon and maybe here even with prior wheat crops is showing that India is about ready to become a net importer of size and substance as opposed to being an exporter. And that's something we haven't seen going back to Norman Borlaug days, going back to the early 1970s. So that's going to be important to price, but maybe more important than anything else is that when I look at the stocks to use ratio of the major exporters, whether it's corn, wheat, or soybeans, we are sitting at or just above record lows, Jeff. So it tells me that when there's a supply disruption, when there's additionality in demand, the markets respond with vigor. So at Ag Resource, we have something called the plateau theory, which is every once in a while, new demand components come to the fore and give us a higher price plateau than where we were before. And we think that happened, of course, with renewable diesel and ethanol, the biofuel sector, if you will. And so I no longer think that the bottom range in corn is 350 or somewhere in there. It's probably that 4 to 450 with upside potential when a weather problem or demand comes up 7 to 7.5. So we've raised that bar, which helps farmers absorb some of these higher costs, because as markets go up, it seemed like everybody has their hand in the pocket of the farmer, at least for a short period of time.
On the supply side of the ledger, between 18 and 23, we've seen Brazilian soybean and corn production certainly on the increase with record crop after record crop. Are they through growing, or is this a paradigm that will continue into the life of this bill?
You know, the Brazilians will continue to grow. They still have, by our estimates at Ag Resource, another 18 to 18.5 million acres available in the Cerrados outside the rainforest. I have an office in Sao Paulo. And so as we calculate this, there's still opportunities. And we do see of course, Brazilian farmer continuing to look at expansion. Nonetheless, Jeff, some of that was due to a very weak Brazilian real. And so quietly in the last few months, the Brazilian real has gone from 5.4 or 5.5 to the dollar, now down to about 4.8, with some analysis, including ours, projecting maybe 4.4 by the first quarter of next year. This has the ability, if you will, to tap the Brazilian farmer down. And people that were looking at expansion are now not quite as robust in that thinking. And I say that because as we calculate their margins in Brazil, that real has had a big influence. And so they're now looking at negative margins, at least up until this week when the Black Sea grain market kind of developed and we had a rally in Chicago. But last week, if you asked me where the Brazilian farmer was sitting, I would say the expansion would be something less than 1%. Normally, Brazilian farmers have been expanding 3 to 4% annually in corn and soybean production.
So Argentina's had its issues with weather this past year, and they certainly have had an ongoing issue with their currency. What's the future for Argentina over the next 60 months?
It's a mess. I mean, whenever you have inflation running at 114%, as it did during the month of June, and farm, if you got out to borrow money as a farmer, you're looking at 105 to 120% depending on the bank. And so you can imagine how debilitating this will be on the Argentinian farmer. There is very limited expansion possibilities under that economic scenario for Argentina looking forward. I've always said Argentina is a country blessed with many, many resources, but a government that takes all of that away and more. And so until the situation changes, I'm afraid that taxation rates are going to be rising, and Brazil is always chasing its tail in regards of having enough currency, hard currency, to pay off its IMF debt. So it's a problem, and it's not a growth market anymore in terms of supplies. That will have to come from elsewhere, and look for farmers to hoard as much corn and soybeans as they can because of inflation, which means that the government will have to roll out dollar corn or dollar soy programs as far as they can see. In other words, selling at an elevated peso price just to get the farmer to let go of something.
You know, prior to this past year, I would have suggested the story of the Black Sea is that of increased production and more supply into the global market. But with Russia's invasion, now there are plenty of questions. And I'm interested, obviously, we can't predict what happens between the two countries, but we have seen now carnal damage. Damage to ports in Odessa, a broken dam there in Ukraine, lasting damage to farm fields. How does this conflict play out in terms of a supply situation for the globe?
Well, first of all, we'd like to, our hearts go out to the Ukrainians, but second of all, if this is going to take a long period of reconstruction that will occur. I mean, it's not only what's happening to infrastructure. There's mines in the fields. Farm fields must be demined, especially in the areas now controlled by Russia. It's going to take a lot of capital. It's going to take a lot of confidence to rebuild the Ukrainian ag economy. I have no idea when the war will end. I hope it's soon. But the longer the war goes on, the more the strife and financial ruin will happen to Ukrainian farmers. I talk to some very regularly. We used to have some as clients. I still stay in contact, and they are probably within one growing season of saying enough is enough and not having the wherewithal to go forward. So each month that we go forward is more concerning, and I have this fear anyway that as we get into next year, Ukraine will have grain crops that probably decline by 20 to 30% with each growing season that the war is ongoing. So that means in roughly a year and a half, Ukraine will not have to worry about a grain export corridor. It will be basically shuttling some grain into Europe and then using the rest itself.
From the supply side of the equation and also from demand, there is China. How is their economy and their appetite for grains and oilseeds? How has it affected us, and what plays out with the Chinese, again, over the life of a new farm bill?
Yeah, the Chinese are the big question mark, and the Chinese control what the Chinese will, of course, be needing or where it sources its grain or its food from. As you look at the Chinese, they are still the U.S.'s largest customer. As we think about farm bills, the worry would be, of course, if there's an invasion of Taiwan and we go to embargoes or changes in trade profiles than what we have today. At the moment, I think both the United States and China understand the importance of trade to each other, and hopefully that's enough to keep parties at a standstill. In other words, China saber-rattling at Taiwan and not moving towards a military conflict. Ultimately, though, as I head to Brazil and travel to that country, more and more do I find the footprints of the Chinese being everywhere in Brazilian agriculture. And so I believe that the Chinese do see Brazil as their next big supplier in the decades to come. I think that they conceivably could buy the soybeans and corn that they need from Brazil. Last year, China was the world's largest wheat importer. Maybe there's a relationship starting with Russia. But I worry about this something we call regionalization of trade. And I know there's been movements against globalization. But if agricultural regionalizes in trade, that's not good for the United States. And so I do worry about that in terms of policy discussions looking forward.
Dan, you weren't shy earlier this year in suggesting what the next-gen biofuel demand might mean for oilseed producers in the U.S., but yet there are headwinds. The EPA's RFS and RVO decisions, the transition and push by the administration toward electric vehicles. Facing these headwinds and higher interest rates, do you think the processing plants will still be built? And is the demand real that they can grow despite what the EPA in Washington says?
Well, it's not only the EPA that has a strong voice at the new biofuels table. It's also California, Washington, and Oregon, and some other states that are looking at legislation. And so these carbon credits and the willingness to be a low to look at low carbon fuels is out there. Our sense is that there was one crush facility that maybe got canceled because someone wanted to trade into another crush facility that was coming online sooner. And so one was canceled, or at least the plans were canceled. But as I do my counts, I'm still coming up with about 610 million bushels of new crush facilities that are coming somewhere by the time frame of early 2026. So that is in play yet, and in some areas or some states like North and South Dakota, there's more crush facilities being built than there are soybeans. That's something that I find very key, interesting, but is going to be very positive on cash basis relationships or the tug of beans into those states as we go forward. On the renewable fuel side, I'm seeing everybody still coming to the table. There's been some issues early on in terms of getting the right ingredients or blends, getting the chemistry right to get whether it's a veg oil or a waste oil through these facilities. We're now seeing that starting to move up, and we're starting to see anyway, from my perspective, where the soy oil demand is large enough on a month-to-month basis that we will not have any exports. step one in this whole, legislation of getting renewable fuels and renewable diesel going was, first of all, to have these crush plants built. They are underway. Concrete is being poured. Step two was getting the United States out of the world trade market in soybean oil. U.S. soybean oil exports this year will be the lowest since 1967. Step three now will be the rally, if you will, in vegetable oil prices. And to the north, this drought, nasty drought in Canada on their canola crop is not going to help that process. And so oil prices, veg oil prices will stay high, which could be somewhat of a slowing or a governor, if you will, on the appetite of renewable fuel people to just hit the go button to start out here right away.
I don't mean to keep the bearish questions coming, but at the same time, the EPA's pending decision on tailpipe emissions by 2027, some suggest that this is an EPA regulatory decision that could go completely away from the internal combustion engine.
Well, Jeff, it could, and again, I look at this legislation, and it all depends on which party is in the White House sometimes and directing the movie script as you will. And we'll look at 2024 very carefully. I try to be non-political, but many times as you think about the future, it depends on which script you want to read from. So as an economist, I have difficulty forecasting forward. It would be a negative omen, there's no doubt. If indeed the combustion engine ends, renewable fuels goes away, there's a tremendous amount of corn and other products that would come back. But I would mention that I don't think anybody plans on flying in a battery-operated plane. So there is this pivot to sustainable aviation fuel, SAF, and I still believe that the diesel engine will have a place at the table just because of its cleanliness and where this could all go. But that's my view, and again, I don't think America is quite ready yet for its elimination of its beloved car.
Dan, one of the other areas, if we look at demand for especially feed grains, first of all, yes, from the renewable fuels area, but primarily from livestock. What's the outlook in livestock and with regard to the reduced number of the cattle herd in the U.S., how long does it take for this particular segment of U.S. agriculture to return?
Well, we just had a cattle inventory report today that showed the U.S. beef cow herd is now at its lowest levels, I think going back to the early 1960s. And honestly, I don't know how the beef cow herd starts to an expansionary phase. In other words, when we start to retain heifers, turn them into cows, normally that's the cattle cycle. It used to last about 9 to 11 years, but now because of the high cost of capital and of course, by not only the rising interest rates, but that we have feeder cattle trading at, you know, $250 to $260. It just has gotten away from Central America. So as I sit here, as far as I can see with any kind of certainty, which is 3 to 4 years, beef prices are going to stay exceptionally high. The cow-calf, man, we just don't have enough of them. And so they are continuing to shrink. And as I think about the availability of beef and the cost these days that maybe it would look at putting up a pork barn or something like that, I'm afraid that the protein side of our plate is going to be relatively constrained, which means that meat prices will stay very, very high for an extended period of time. This is something I think we need to worry about. I hope that the market provides incentives, but as you look at cash cattle trading at $1.80 a pound, the consumer is surely going to be worried by the rising price of protein as we look forward for the next 5 years.
USTR is not governed, obviously, by USDA or by the Farm Bill, but trade policy does have an impact on price discovery and on the bottom line of producers in the country. One administration was all about trade. Another administration hasn't spent as much time talking about trade. How important will trade policy be moving forward, and what happens if we don't?
I always believe that trade policy in agriculture is always important. At least in my 44 years of watching this business, trade is the ingredient that changes markets and offers opportunities. So I'm a big pro-trader, if you will. I believe that the United States needs to stay focused on trade. And again, depending on administrations, I believe this is going to be important. It's the linchpin, if you will, to profitability for U.S. farmers, as it is that one ingredient that is able to lift or depress markets with ease. So as China potentially gets to a spot where maybe its soybean imports aren't as robust as they have been for the past two decades. By that, I'm saying their hog herd seems to be leveling off. If that is indeed the case, we may see some stagnation in terms of Chinese trade. And with that, we need to pivot and look for new opportunities around the world. And my hope is that it will be India or Africa. But again, this is why trade is important. We always need to be looking for market opportunities.
Dan, I am told by producers that their two primary risk management tools are crop insurance and obviously now the futures and or options market in managing risk. If we look at the programs that they stand today, especially for bulk commodities, the reference price under PLC is well below the cost of production. Is it time for a paradigm shift in policy where the government could leverage a market position without having to put up whole dollars to support farms?
Well, I think that should be the case. I mean, PLC levels and all of the other things need to adjust, of course, with the market. It's been a farm bill or two before we've made the adjustments on those. I think the farm revenue side of things would argue that indeed they need to move higher. My own sense is that when you look at the markets, we should have opportunities for farmers to make good sales at higher price levels, as I mentioned, through the plateau theory. But in saying that, I think the safety net needs to be snugged up. And so when you think about PLC, it needs to come up, and we need to have price levels or barometers that give bankers and farmers more stability. One of the things that really sticks out to me in agriculture these days is the amount of capital it takes to be in business. And I know if you're a young farmer just starting out in agriculture, you can get a loan from USDA at around $600,000, but that hardly buys you anything more than a couple of acres and a couple of tractors. The capital side of things is really what the bankers are looking at. And with that, I believe that the safety net needs to be snugged and raised so that it reflects the true cost of cost in terms of being in the agricultural business.
Well, Dan Bassi, we want to thank you very much for taking time to be with us on this edition of Open Mic. And our congratulations to you for a rich tenure and career of working with producers, working with customers around the globe, and developing a company with insights that help producers, that help end users, that hopefully might help policymakers look at direction. We want to provide the opportunity, Dan, for an open mic, but I also invite you as well to hear your guidance as you're looking at policy that will be developed that supports and provides a safety net for producers. What does experience tell you about now as you take advantage of this open mic situation?
Well, Jeff, as we look at coming decades, the one thing that really stands out to me is that, you know, the United States has reached something that we call at Ag Resource peak farmland. And when I look at peak farmland, that means that we have about 270 million acres of cropland, give or take a few million. And then, of course, there's hay acres that are involved. Last year, those hay acres were the lowest since 1909, and now they've come back a little bit under the last survey. But when I look at the acreage miss, don't fool around with acreage, I guess, is my message, in that, you know, we need all of these acres. As America expands its population, as we look at the opportunities to the world, I worry that climate change and great variability in yield. By that, I'm saying when I look at my data, the per capita grain yield globally is now starting to stagnate. We believe this is because of something called, maybe a word that's not true, but heatflation. And so if we don't have more yield, in other words, farmers increasing global yield each and every year through advanced technology, through better seeds, through all the things that happen, then we need more acres. And if we start looking at available acres in the world marketplace, that kind of reaches a peak somewhere between 2065 and 2070. You know, that seems like a long ways away to you and I, but on a longer-term standpoint for humanity, that's not the case. So as we add another billion people by 2035, the food table globally and domestically becomes more important to every family. And so policymakers need to be aware of that, need to give farmers the utmost opportunity to produce as much crop as they can. And I hope technology will get us to places that we're friendly to the environment, we understand soil science, and we really get to a spot where we're similar to the Brazilians to some degree, producing multiple crops in a single year and getting to a point that we can feed everybody at a very competitive price.
Our thanks to Dan Bossi, president of Ag Resource Company, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Daly.